welcome to Leading with Impact. My name is Tina Deutsch, and I'm convinced that leadership has a new imperative today. The best leaders inspire to act and define success through positive impact. In this podcast, I speak with exactly these people, and I present the most exciting concepts that make top leaders successful today. My guest today is a very special person who will be able to teach us really interesting things about what the world thinks. John is global managing partner at Gallup, who most of our listeners probably know for their polling activities, but you'll tell us a bit more about what Gallup does in a bit. John, you have appeared on a multitude of news outlets, including prestigious names like the BBC News or the Washington Journal. And when it comes to what you spend your time thinking about, you say you want to fix the world's broken workplace where only 13% of people are really engaged. And you believe that companies are going to be much more about purpose and less about profit as a result of the current world events. John, you join me out of Washington today, and I'm really looking forward to our talk. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Tina, it's great to be here, and thank you for having me.
Maybe we just start with you telling us a little bit more about Gallup. I just said before, most listeners probably know the polling side of Gallup most, but Gallup does much more. Can you tell us a little bit what the global portfolio of Gallup encompasses?
Absolutely. As part of our overall purpose as a company, one of the things that we're trying to do is fix the world's broken workplace. And as you mentioned earlier, we find that only 15% of people around the world are actually engaged in their work. And obviously what that concludes is that 85% are not. And so with projects that we do with large companies, large government organizations, we go in and help create better workplaces.
Great, thank you. There's one thing that you have been doing since 2005 is the Gallup World Poll. As far as I know, Gallup surveys citizens in I think 160 countries, representing more than 98% of the world's adult population. And the poll includes various themes, but also jobs and well-being. Can you say, like, what are people's most pressing work and life issues? Can one summarize that?
Absolutely. And just to give a little bit more context as to exactly what it is that we're doing, you know, global leaders right now, I think their primary objective is to make people's lives better. But the problem is that in order to understand whether or not people's lives are getting better, they look to economic indicators to determine whether or not people's lives are getting better. The problem with that is best described as the story where if you build a prison in the middle of a community, GDP will rise, but it doesn't necessarily mean that people's lives are getting better. And so we wanted to fix that. And so we built a set of indicators to just point blank ask people, how is your life going? So that we could report these to leaders everywhere and get a better gauge of whether or not people's lives are actually getting better. So that was the point of the Gallup World Poll. And we find in our research that the single biggest driver of what makes a great life is a great job. And that's why it's so critical for us to work with companies, work with public sector entities in order to make more engaging environments, because we believe that that's really the silver bullet to create a great life.
I mean, that's so incredible. And I think many leaders don't internalize what that means in terms of responsibility, because if the job has such a huge impact on people's happiness or well-being, then it also means that a leader's responsibility of creating a workplace that makes people thrive is pretty big. So I read while preparing for this talk, I read that while GDP in the UK was growing and unemployment had dropped, so from an economic perspective, things kind of seemed okay. In the 2 years leading up to Brexit, Gallup found that the percentage of people who were thriving or happy was in dramatic decline. And I think the same kind of happened in the US with a recovering economy, but how Americans felt about their lives ahead of the 2016 election that kind of declined. So can you tell us more about this KPI of thriving? What does it mean, and why is it not positively correlated with, or not necessarily positively correlated with GDP or other economic factors?
Well, let's start with what is it? What are we measuring? And so the way that we capture the percent of people thriving is through two questions in a global survey. The first question is rate your life on a scale of 0 to 10. 0 is the worst possible life and 10 is the best possible life. Where do you stand today? Once people tell us that number, we then ask them a follow-up question, which is, and where do you think you'll be in the next 5 years? If people say that their lives are a 7, 8, 9, or 10 today, and an 8, 9, or 10 in the next 5 years, we consider them to be thriving. And that's not an arbitrary cut point. If people rate their lives that highly, we find that it correlates with kind of everything else that makes a great life. We find that they're usually engaged in their jobs. We find that they have enough money for food. We find that they don't experience a great deal of loneliness, that they're having a great deal of positive experiences in their life. So that's why these cut points, as I mentioned, are not arbitrary. So interestingly enough, though, we find that those indicators do highly correlate with GDP per capita. And rich countries rate their lives higher. Poorer countries rate their lives lower. But what's so interesting is how those indicators go over time and why I think it's so important to leaders. You brought up two examples. We did find a decline in the percent of people that were thriving in the two-year period before Brexit, despite the fact that economic indicators told us that things largely were okay in the UK. And also in the United States, although at the macro level, it looked largely flat, we found that in sort of district areas that voted for Trump, those were places where people's thriving was declining far more dramatically. But in addition to those two examples, we've also seen massive declines in Tunisia before the Arab Spring, in Egypt before the Arab Spring, and also in Bahrain. And the last example, before the Euromaidan revolution in Ukraine, we saw exactly the same decline. Now, these declines sometimes are about 10 to 12%, which somebody might say, is that really significant? But imagine if there was a similar rise in unemployment, a 10% rise in unemployment. And if it went from, you know, I think this morning here in the United States, it's about 6.5%. If it was 16.5%, it would be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. But for some reason, when people's how they rate their life and how they see their life changes dramatically, it goes almost totally missed, but it doesn't go missed by the people themselves. And that's exactly what it is that we're trying to capture.
So if thriving is an indicator for, you know, possible unrest, how people feel about their lives influences how they vote in elections. Can you say that the same is true in organizations?
The most important thing that leaders in organizations need to keep in mind is that what we consider the entire person, the whole person, comes to work every single day. So I think decades ago, we believed that a human being, when they show up to work, that whatever they have going on in their life stops immediately when they walk into work and they become a different person. That's not true. And that's not how the human mind works. If somebody's well-being is collapsing for a reason, even disconnected to work, you can actually see that that gets brought in and there's a problem. Their productivity will slump. Their just kind of everything that's concerning follows them into the office. And this is ultimately why leaders and managers need to care more than just the person's work product, but they also need to care about the person as a whole. But there's also the opposite effect, because your work, if you're miserable there, in the work that you do, it can actually make your life miserable. We find that people who are actively disengaged in their work, they actually will tell us openly that they bring that misery from work back to their household every single day. So it's not just a miserable job is bad for the person, it's bad for their family and the loved ones next to them. So this is why leaders in the private sector need to care a lot more about just a person's output or productivity. They also need to care about the person as a whole.
So, I mean, just to play devil's advocate, I mean, I understand what you're saying, obviously, but is it really an organization's and the leader's responsibility to manage the whole person? And how can I even do that as a leader? I mean, I might have influence on the organization and its structure and processes and culture, but do I have an influence on the rest of the life of a person that I'm managing? And is that really part of my job? Is there no boundary to what I'm both responsible for, but maybe also what my business is?
You're 100% right. But statistically, without question, a manager impacts how somebody's life is going. Why? Because the single biggest driver to somebody's life is their work. And 70% of somebody's emotional attachment to their work is determined by their manager. So no matter what, statistically, there is a massive impact on that person's overall life, just in terms of what happens in half of their waking hours of a day. But to your point, you know, we find that there are five drivers of what make a great life. So your career and purpose is that first one, your community well-being, your physical well-being, your financial well-being, and your social well-being. So, physical well-being, take for example, how does your manager really impact your physical well-being? And the point is that they need to have a mindfulness. They need to have an awareness and create an environment where it does play to somebody's physical well-being. For example, in this sort of coronavirus environment, one thing that a manager can do is encourage their team to do calls while they're all walking. Encourage everybody to get on a call and to do a walk together as they actually have this particular team call. They don't need to sit in front of a Zoom, but that's just an awareness to be thoughtful about the people on your team and thinking about their well-being. And again, a roadmap to just consider the well-being of everybody are those five elements that I just mentioned. So maybe it's not a physical well-being, but maybe it is a social well-being. So a manager that I work with very closely noticed that we measure a thing called best friend at work is a little bit low. So one of the things he did is said, you guys, you don't have to join, but if you want to, once a quarter, we're going to do a book club afterward. I'm going to buy the books. He sent everybody the books and said, let's just talk about it afterward. That may or may not help them create better relationships in the workplace. And it also might help create better social relationships because we know loneliness is killer. There was one white paper that was done that finds that loneliness, if you have basically no friends at all, it's the same thing as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So it's something really serious. And again, a manager just needs to be aware of it, needs to be thoughtful, look for various activities that they can do to help. But again, they're not going to drive the entire person's life, clearly.
So now you've talked about thriving and, you know, told us about the questions that you asked to measure that. But you've also said engagement a lot of the time. What's the difference between engagement and thriving?
So thriving is a metric for how you see your life, on how you rate your life. And that's where we ask people to just say, rate your life on a scale of 0 to 10. And most people are familiar with this metric because the World Happiness Report that determines who are the happiest countries in the world actually use that data from Gallup in order to inform people about that. Engagement is a different metric. Engagement is the emotional attachment that you have to your job and to your workplace. And we measure that with 12 different questions that have a lot more to do with that emotional attachment. So the first thing that we ask people is just, do you know what's expected of you at work? And that seems like completely low-hanging fruit. But it also surprises people to learn that only 50% of people around the world can strongly agree to that question that they know what they're supposed to be doing. That means 50% don't strongly agree. And that means they're not entirely sure what they're supposed to be doing at their place of work. And by the way, that one item is so particularly profound because imagine if those 50% were actually sat down and told exactly what's expected of them. Imagine what we could do, not just for how they're doing in their jobs, but what we could do for human development. The second thing that we ask is just, do the people have the things that they need in order to do their job effectively? Mm-hmm. Only 40% of the world strongly agrees to this particular item. And that's concerning because when you talk with people about exactly what it is that they need in terms of materials and resources, a lot of the times it's not terribly significant. It's not a multi-million dollar investment to get them something that they need to do their job a little bit more effectively. And sometimes it's just a manager that's willing to listen. And then the last one I'll say, just three of the 12 questions, is what I think is potentially one of the most powerful that we ask, which is, do you have the opportunity to do what you do best? And, you know, I think this is one of the questions that I think, you know, modern business thinkers like Peter Drucker, all the way back to philosophers like Aristotle, who are wondering about people serving their purpose. I think this is a question that helps us understand whether or not people have the opportunity to serve their purpose at work. But only a third of people around the world say that they have the opportunity to do what they do best and strongly agree to that, Adam. So that's really concerning. And again, this is why we have tools like Gallup's Clifton Strengths Finder to help people identify what it is that makes them great, so managers can best set them up for success.
Can you explain the basic principle of the Strengths Finder and what's your personal connection with it? Maybe you can tell me a little bit more about its history.
So kind of the philosophy behind Clifton Strengths Finder is this idea that we could help people discover what it is that makes them great. And I think if you look back to these business thinkers like Peter Drucker, all the way back to ancient philosophers, what we know is that all of them sort of recommend the same thing, which is if you want to have a great life and serve your purpose, you've got to start with your strengths. The problem is none of them told us where to start. And so the idea behind Clifton Strengths was this is a way to help people get started on their journey to figure out their purpose. Because I think your purpose starts with knowing what it is that makes you great. And the person that helped create this is a man by the name of Don Clifton, which is actually my grandfather. And Don Clifton, after serving in World War II, came back to the University of Nebraska. He was a student. He eventually got his PhD, and then he taught at the university. But Don Clifton was in the psychology department, and much of everything that he studied was what's wrong with people. So Don Clifton would study thinkers like Freud, for example, and everything Freud had listed is what's wrong with people. And he thought to himself, why is it that there isn't any material on what's right with people? And so he actually walked down to the library at the University of Nebraska one afternoon and said, I'm going to go find the books on what's right with people. And he's standing there looking for a very long time. And it occurs to him, there are no books on what's right with people. Mm-hmm. And it was at that moment when he said, I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life to writing the book on what's right with people. And that is ultimately what created Strengths Finder, or what we now call Clifton Strengths Finder, in memory of him. And he originally created the book Now Discover Your Strengths, which was published just over 20 years ago, allowing people then to go through this instrument, which then became a new book, which is Strengths Finder 2.0, and we updated the instrument. And at one point, it was the best-selling book on Amazon for 4 straight years. Even more than some of those other titles. And I think it's because people, you know, in so many workplaces around the world are told to fix what's wrong with them. And I think it really causes a lot of people to lose energy because they're constantly told to fix things or to build upon something that they don't have an inherent talent for. And they don't exist in environments where they can build on what makes them great. And this ultimately is something that I think a lot of people have gone to because they said, wow, it's finally an instrument that's telling me what's right with me, and I can build on these to make a strength.
It's so interesting because it's so intuitively right, but still there's so many organizations who just ignore this knowledge, even if you listen to what you're saying and it's completely clear that it's right. But I guess what often comes in the way is, you know, just life happening. Like, things go so fast and it's all about results and it's all about delivering quarterly targets. And what it feels like to a lot of leaders is, I don't have time for this. I don't have time for the luxury of, you know, thinking about what John might, you know, want to do or what his strengths might be. But, you know, I have a job description, and if you want to have the job, this is what you do. Otherwise, maybe you shouldn't have applied. And I, you know, this focus on, you know, I want to do what empowers you and what makes you thrive is great. But if I just spent my time constantly thinking about what your strengths are instead of what the organization needs, then, you know, I waste a lot of time. So I think this is happening in a lot of leaders' minds. Do you hear this sometimes?
You are 100% correct. I think the fallacy of past management practices is that people are built the same. We are all built like blank canvases, and you can basically mold people to however you want, or that we're a pair of hands or a robot that show up to work every single day, and we should be molded into other people who have been successful in a particular role that we've taken on. That is totally flawed, because we are not all built the same. And this ultimately, what we built attempts to show people how different we are, and to actually use those differences in a very positive, constructive way, not just to make people more productive at work, not just to make people more emotionally attached, but also to help have them live better lives.
Last follow-up question, because, you know, there's this principle when you look at organizations that you say, or a lot of people say, organization first and people second, in the sense that you can't, especially at a certain size of a company, you can't shape jobs to fit people's needs. At some point, you need to say, these are the type of jobs we have and we need. And then you need to find the people that fit these jobs. In a small company, let's say 10 people, 15 people, maybe even 100 people, you can say, I find the best people, and then I will mold the jobs and the organization so that it fits these people's strengths and talents and wishes. But at a certain point, that doesn't seem possible anymore. So does that mean if I need to replace people because at some point they quit their jobs and things just change, I can't just change the job every time a new person comes in just because this person now has different strengths. How do I deal with this?
Well, I think that's the beauty of people's strengths, because everybody achieves something differently. What we need to do is hold people to a common standard of what success looks like in the job, and then let them use their strengths in order to achieve whatever that mission is. You had asked also a little bit about, you know, what unites us when we join an organization. Ultimately, I think it's the purpose of the organization. I think the purpose of the organization comes first. So whatever that purpose is that everybody, you know, rallies around and says, this is the purpose that we're trying to achieve. And there are a lot of CEOs that now do this. Their purpose is not to make money. They're saying our purpose is to do something very functional in society. We work with a number of companies. One, for example, they say their purpose through various healthcare equipment is to better the lives of women. And so now they're even trying to quantify how women's lives are going around the planet so that they can serve that mission no matter what it is that they do. So I think what leaders need to do is speak to everybody that they work with in a workplace to say, here's exactly what our purpose is. And then for each of them in their particular role, let them use their strengths, coach them around their strengths in order to achieve each of their individual missions so that the company can achieve its overall purpose.
So I think if I look at it, you know, from the outside, and of course I'm less partial, then I think what strikes is this very specific focus on strengths. You have a lot of stuff out there that focuses on personality, on preferences, on values, and of course also all kinds of assessments that focus on strengths and weaknesses, or as they're called, development areas in some instances. So why is it so important in your view to look specifically at a person's strengths as opposed to weaknesses? I guess a lot of people would agree that in the working world, you know, most of the times people tend to look at both and say, there's some strengths that I should strengthen, yes, but there may be also one or two or three areas of development that I should look at that, you know, maybe inhibit my career development and my personal development. Why is this focus not there at all?
Well, I wouldn't say that the focus is not there at all, because we definitely, in the literature that we provide people who, you know, go through the process of discovering their strengths, we do tell them where their weaknesses are. And interestingly enough, although we give a list of people's 34 strengths, a lot of times people look at the list and they go, oh, the very bottom five must be my weaknesses. All right. And those are actually not what we consider weaknesses. We consider those to be your lesser talents or your lesser themes. What we consider somebody's weaknesses actually exist in their top five strengths. And we often refer to this, I'm going to use the old language. So if any of my colleagues at Gallup listen to this, forgive me, but we call them balconies, which is basically the pinnacle of your strength, and then basements, which are kind of the bad parts of your strengths. And so, for example, my number one theme is competition. So the upside of competition is that if you show me a list of numbers comparing me to somebody else, I will work tirelessly to ensure that no matter what happens, I can beat those particular numbers. But the basement of competition is that people with competition can be overly competitive and can turn people off. And so mastering a strength means having awareness of that. It means having awareness of the fact that not everybody's built the same. Not everybody has competition. Not everybody enjoys competing. Not everybody goes into what Mihail Csikszentmihalyi would say is flow. And that when I'm in competition, I'm in flow. Time absolutely stops. I enjoy what I'm doing. I work harder. I focus more. But for others who don't get energy from that. In fact, we had a manager that had someone on their team and actually managed them as if they had competition. And the person said back to him, just so you know, I don't have competition. So when you keep measuring me compared to other people, it doesn't further advance me as a person here. And I think that brings just another point that I think is so important for all your listeners, which is the importance of a common language of strengths. Because in the absence of describing those 34 things that make people great, that conversation could not have taken place. Because that manager believed that everybody had competition. He saw the world through his eyes and his eyes only. But that one particular person on his team said, no, actually, I don't see the world the same way that you do. And in fact, my number one theme is strategic. And so when he would do business development pursuits or whatever it looked like, he went into it with strategy, not with competition. And that's what gave him energy. And that's what put him into flow.
That's super interesting. And I guess this common language can make a lot of conversations much easier. When and where should it be used? For making hiring decisions, for development purposes, for individuals or for teams?
Definitely with individual development and team development. I don't think there's any single thing that can drive team engagement, team productivity, and team collaboration like there is with strengths. And again, the reason is Don Clifton had a great quote where he said, strengths only grow in relation to another person. I think what he meant was this realization that when somebody discovers their strengths, they're kind of like, yeah, but I have competition in my top five. Isn't everybody competitive? The realization is that they're not. And this gives everybody a lens to see the world the way that somebody else sees the world and not through your own lens. And it's really powerful on teams. We can see through data that when teams are strengths enabled, so when they get in touch with their strengths, when they go through the right kind of training and see each other's strengths, that actually has a massive impact on their engagement and on their productivity.
So now that you mentioned teams, I mean, the assessment looks at individual strengths, right? What about the team perspective? Isn't there, complementary strengths or something in a team? And can you assess a team's strengths portfolio or something like that?
Without question. And so the way that we approach this process is when you take each individual's top five or top 10 strengths, we create what's called a team grid. And then you can actually see, and we use color coding in terms of each of kind of our strengths themes. So we have influencing themes, relating themes, thinking themes, and these sort of what I call doing themes. But each of them then come into a color, and then you can see exactly what is your team dominating. I mean, so there might be a team that's a very thoughtful team and they have huge thinking themes. They may have the absence of influencing themes. And so what that has allowed us to do from an organizational perspective is if there's a team that's struggling to, I don't know, increase their budget or get a particular project through, we can say to them, this is more, there's no gap in terms of potentially what it is that you're delivering. You may have a very human gap, which is you need somebody to advocate for you because you guys are brilliant thinkers, but you're not necessarily advocates. And so one of the best things to do is identify somebody in the organization who is an advocate, and then that is what creates a beautiful partnership. But we've also found that there is really no perfect team blend of strengths. So although we do say that individuals are not necessarily, well, they shouldn't be well-rounded, they should be spiky, that's what strengths look like, that maybe it's better if a team is well-rounded, but the single thing that predicts an engaged team is just whether or not they know each other's strengths, whether or not they speak a language and they understand what they on their team does really well. And that's what strengths helps them do.
So how would you recognize an organization that thinks and acts strengths focused? How do leaders and employees act differently in an organization that has this type of view and thinking?
Well, we can quantify it. And so if we go in and we conduct a survey and we ask people to tell us whether on a scale of 1 to 5, they have the opportunity to do what they do best in an organization that's strengths-based or strengths-enabled, people give a 5 very often on that. And we find that they're far more engaged. And in places where people don't have the opportunity to do what they do best, we can see that there's usually a massive strengths deficit. But the other thing is, from a qualitative perspective, if you meet with leaders where they do have a strengths-based organization, you can hear it in their language. They talk to each other about what makes each other great. I talked to a very senior leader at a university. In fact, she's now chancellor at another university, but she has such a strengths-based environment and atmosphere that I even said to her, what are the top 5 strengths of basically your deputy? She actually just ripped off her deputy's top 5 strengths, then went further and said, this is exactly how you see my deputy's strengths in action on a daily basis. I think the pinnacle of what a strengths-based organization looks like is where qualitatively you can feel it when executives talk about what their colleagues do best.
That's beautiful. So if you had one recommendation for leaders, a very practical recommendation for leaders to increase coming back to thriving and engagement, to increase their employees, let's say both thriving and engagement, something that really any leader in any organization can do, what would come to mind as your top tip that anyone can really do tomorrow?
So I would say there are 3 things. And I think the first one, in August of 2019, almost 200 CEOs came together in the United States and said that they were going to reimagine the purpose of a corporation. And that's ultimately what we know as stakeholder capitalism. And that's where reimagining this idea that really shareholders are really the only stakeholder that we care about, we should also think more broadly and think of our employees, our customers, our suppliers, and our communities. I think that's definitely the right move. Now, exactly how that needs to be done is really important, because I think a lot of times, in fact, there's a Harvard study that came out that criticizes many of these CEOs because they said they didn't get board approval in order to sign this document, and therefore it's all lip service. I'm not necessarily sure that that's exactly true, but I do think we need to have data that if we're going to report just like our profit or our stock price, we also need to have these indicators on how are our suppliers doing, how are our customers doing, how are our communities doing, and definitely how are our employees doing. And I think if they report those indicators just like they do you know, their profit or their overall revenue numbers, I think you will actually see stakeholder capitalism take hold and be the most effective version of itself that it can be. That's number one. The second thing is, I do think organizations, if they are going to commit to their employees, they do need to commit to becoming strengths-based organizations. I'm not saying that just because this is something that Gallup does. I'm saying it because I've seen it in the data and I've seen it in the science. I think enabling people with their strengths, going in and doing effective assessments that, you know, help people understand what it is that make them great and put them in positions to succeed, so that they're doing those type of activities, I think not only helps to a more productive workplace, I think it also leads to just people who have better lives. And then the last thing I think is this concept of engaged employees. And I think right now leadership has confused engaged employees with satisfied employees. And I think a lot of times they think satisfaction, and they'll build strategies on ping pong tables, on, I don't know, free beer or something, some activities like that, when that is not what people ultimately need in order to have an emotional attachment to their work. What they need are the things that I had mentioned earlier, like they need to know what's expected of them. They need somebody, a manager or somebody at the office that cares about them. They need to feel like they have been recognized for doing good work very recently. Those are the human needs that make somebody attached to a job and to a workplace. And not only making a commitment about that, but I think also just there are various training programs that you know, CEOs can just get for their managers, because if 70% of engagement is determined by the manager, then somebody needs to help them determine how to effectively manage that 70%. And ultimately it comes in training, because people who are named manager in an organization are named manager most likely because they excelled at what they did, not because they're great managers. And that's a massive problem in workplaces, because just because you're the best engineer, just because you're the top salesperson, doesn't mean that you're going to be an amazing manager. And the other thing is, you may have not ever been properly trained on it. You don't know the importance of recognition. You might not necessarily know the importance of sitting down and explaining exactly what is needed from the team. And I think just simple training can fix that. And so I would recommend, as number three, for organizations to do that sort of wide training where they work with managers on how to properly engage employees.
Yeah, and I can underline that so many times. I mean, obviously, as one of the market leaders in personal development and leadership development, and working with hundreds and in truth thousands of coaches and trainers in the region, this is like the thing we think about on a daily basis. And as you said, it's really interesting that there's so many jobs you're prepared for, but management or leadership, you're just made a manager without any type of preparation many times. So I can just underline that many times. Thank you so much for your insights today. I think the combination of statistics and data, and then your personal interpretations and the many examples you could give are super interesting for our listeners. So thank you so much for taking the time, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again soon.
Tina, thank you for having me.
And this was today's episode of Leading with Impact. The best leaders inspire action and define success through positive impact. In this podcast, I therefore speak with exactly these people, and I present the most exciting concepts that make top leaders successful today. We're always happy about feedback. You'll find contact possibilities and all other contents in the show notes.